All right, welcome back to the fifth episode, fifth installment of the Slide In podcast. We filmed episode four this morning, so if something terrible happened, we won't know about it yet. And you might listen to it 2 weeks from now. So, Kelly, welcome. How are you doing since we talked 10 minutes ago?
Well, I've had a complete change of life. I put my coffee down. I'm drinking my 1,000 milliliters of water. See the kilonewton? Seen these yet? Cool. I drink a lot of water anyway, but I'm a tea guy now. I don't drink coffee, except for I did an hour ago. Of course, that goes right through you, so.
Now we're on the tea.
Tea. I'm a little stickers inside there. Lady Grey's my favorite.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah, it's great.
Why don't we spend the whole time talking about tea?
Tea and scotch, you know.
All right, well, let's jump in on that note. I wanted to start off today's episode by talking a little bit about some great streamer anglers, you know. So myself and Johnny aside, you can't pick us. Who do you think is one of the best streamer anglers?
I'm going to pick my nose and pick you, too.
Who do you think is one of the best streamer anglers you've ever seen? You can't pick yourself either. Should have said that.
I wouldn't put me in it. I know guys a lot better than me. Johnny's definitely up there. Boy, there's a lot of them back, you know. I would say, I mean, Russ Madden obviously is going to be top two. Russ is incredible. Alex Lufkus, those guys. Most of the guys I knew from Michigan that were all proteges, I guess you'd say, of Russ. he was spectacular. Skinny is a really good streamer. Steve Mock, he's really good. You know, there's a lot of them. Larry Larson down at in Pocatello, Snake River Outfitters, or Guides, I can't remember. But there's a handful, but not, and I mean there's lots and lots more that I don't fish with daily, so it doesn't come right to my mind. My buddy Chet's really good. Pretty much anybody I knew back in the early days of writing the book that were spectacular. Just really good, and lots of really good client anglers, too. I mean, I can't put a name on everybody. It's just in the last 10 years, 80% of that I fished alone. And then when I go somewhere, I mean, wherever I go, Jack Ford was a spectacular one. Kelly Newman's really good. Guys that I'd fish with, generally it was only on the white. Yeah. I mean, that's the only time I would fish with anybody other than you guys. And you know, I can only take so much of Johnny. But it pretty much, it's a small circle because I just don't get to fish with them.
Right.
I see a lot of guys post some really great pictures up. I assume they're really good. Yeah. I don't know.
It's hard to know unless you're seeing them.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, the guys who that I fish with most. But it's like you said, the for lack of a better term, the modern angler streamer guys, that do multiple retrieves and have multiple, you know, multiple techniques. There's just, that's pretty new. And so, and I'm sure as soon as I stop, you know, we walk out of here and drive home, I'm going to go, holy shit. And I'm going to remember about 10 other people. But I just don't get to, Mickey Wooten. I fished with Mickey once on the white. I've only fished with Mickey a couple of times. He's great guide up in, oh my God. If I was going to fish in the park, that'd be the only guy I would ever hire.
He's a hell of a dude, too.
Oh my God. Yeah. Great musician. But anyway, it's just, and he's a really, really, really good tire. But I fish with him on the white, and he's really good. But I just don't get to fish with people much. You know, my time's limited, and when I do fish, you know, I usually alone or with one of you guys, and you don't count, so.
Also, for those wondering, we are going to have Johnny on the podcast.
What a drag.
I know Kelly's bummed about it. I convinced him we have to do it. So he's come back next week, and they're going to square off. I'll try to get between them if they fight, but I won't be able to do much. Another question I had for you, and really this is kind of based on my experience. I'm obviously much newer to fly fishing than people like yourself and Johnny, probably because of age. But
what are you trying to say?
Nothing. And I was trying to go back and think about some of the light bulb moments I had as I've become a better angler, as I've improved my own skill. And I thought it might be helpful for some of our listeners out there who are trying to improve. You know, I'm sure some people are watching this for enjoyment. Some people are watching it for tips. And one of the big light bulb moments I had was via watching you fish and filming you, the breakdown between reactive bites and food-based bites. And the moment that hit me was we were on that tiny water in Chile. And, you know, we're throwing big stuff. You're throwing big stuff, chartreuse stuff, white stuff, and nothing's happening. So you flip over to a tan and brown peanut envy that was imitating lamprey. And immediately got three nice fish, I think two rainbows that are brown. They came out with their fins, they weren't jacked up. They came out super slow and ate the fly. And then
The food bite.
The food bite, exactly. So I started cataloging all of these eats that I had memories of. And started putting them in the box of reactive versus food-based. And it really, helped me understand how to move a fly and how to change how you're moving a fly depending on what you're getting. And the majority of the big browns I've ever caught are on that reactive bite. But that's because I fish to that reactive bite because I like it more. But will you just talk a little bit about kind of those bites and how to understand what a fish is doing, kind of when to target a different type of bite?
There are some ways to target that. Skylight can be a big one. Low light conditions, really low cloud cover, low ceilings, you know, that kind of, and what I think happens is that fish are nocturnal feeders, right? Brown trout in particular are nocturnal feeders. And so when they prefer to, like, evenings and early light. It's low light's what it is. And so if you get a really low cloud, you know, cover and it's stable, it's going to sit there all day, you're going to go probably more into your food bites. So, but to break it down, the reason you hit it before I got to it was the reason you've caught so many more on reactionary bites is because that's what you fished. And that's what I would say, and I preach this one till it's dead. Most people are line pullers. That's what they do. And that's really a reactionary because that's really all you have is a pretty fast moving bite thing, right? And so you get reactionary bites generally on brighter, sunnier days. Not always. There's like I said it a million times, there's no always and no never. There's just fish break the rules. They just change up, you know, that's why you have to have data points that you can go back to. That's why I change the flies when they're working. Okay, it's 70 and sunny and everything's beautiful in the world and they're eating this. Okay, let's try something else. Same with the dark flies, dark based stuff. So reactionary bites are generally pretty stable. Everything's cool. Everybody's happy. There's no big shifts in water temperatures, generally a higher water temperature deal for that, or at least a stable. Doesn't necessarily have to be a higher. For example, like on the white never gets warm. It's coming out of that giant reservoir, same water temperature all the time. And so they just get in moods, right? And so reactionary bites, you start, And it's the funnest for sure.
Definitely.
I mean, it's the easiest, really, because when they're jacked up and they're going to come and get it, they're going to come and get it. And so generally speaking on a reactionary day, and how you know, I usually start white, and unless the water temperature is really cold. Even then, I tend to, just because I like to start there. It's my starting point. And then I go through that color change very quickly, you know, white, black, tan, olive, chartreuse, and yellow. It's kind of my standard thing, and I go through that. And so, but I have always said and always preached, and one of the other ones we talked about it, is that I start pretty fast to see if the fish are going to be jacked up. If they're going to shark me and get that finny thing going, you know, get crazy, you know you're going to have a reactionary day. Now, the day we were fishing in Chile, was that the No Name River?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that day, we knew there were big fish in that ditch, and kind of a small little thing, you know, tight. And so, but it was bright, sunny. Everything screamed reactionary bite day.
You started with a white flathead kitty.
Flat out.
I thought we were going to
kill it.
Get him right out of the gate.
Absolutely crush it. And I think we had one show right away, which is a kiss of death. That's like a first, like you're a steelheader and you do a first cast steelhead, just go home. It's just like, I'm telling you, it's going to just suck. I don't know why. Seven times I had that guiding where I first cast fish and never got a bite the rest of the day.
Just got to get the first cast out of
there. Yeah, throw it in a tree. But anyway, that day, so it's going and everything is right in the world. High sun, high everything, you know, and generally speaking, super high sun would tell you as a brown trout angler, or even a big rainbows, they're not going to be quite as, they're going to be a little shy, right?
A little skittish.
Yeah, theoretically, I don't buy into that personally. I just think
it's conventional wisdom,
yeah.
Right?
And so, but I think big bright days, I'm thinking chartreuse and, you know, white, chartreuse and white, chartreuse, yellow, you know, something just obnoxiously in your face. And so we fished for a while, and then, but you, that's the whole point of being able to cut a fly off and change and have a data point saying, okay, they should. When you say they should, an hour into that day, you just wasted a half hour at least, right? Because they either are or they aren't.
Yeah.
As, you know, kind of the difference between Johnny, it's kind of like Keith Richards said when they asked him, how do you keep your cool? How can you at your age just carry your cool still? He goes, it's simple, mate. You either is or you ain't.
Is or you ain't.
Sorry, Johnny. And so, but at any rate, it either is or it isn't, right? Or is it, it ain't. And they weren't on. They weren't doing shit. Nothing was happening. And yet, man, some of that water we crossed. And so you can do your color thing. You can, and it, you know, what I always preach, color first, cadence second. So color first is reactionary bite. And then, but I'm burning through colors. I'm speed. I'm going fast. I'm doing, getting great water. I mean, spectacular water. You know, nobody's been in maybe a week, maybe more. And so in there, and then we got to a little canopy of stuff and a lot of shadow. And so then it's not working on the reactionary. So don't keep hitting yourself in the head. And so went to a smaller version of Peanut Envy, brown and tan. That's the original color, actually. It was the brown and tan. That was done as a chestnut lamprey down on the Henry's Fork between the falls and warm and at Cardiac. And so I saw these, like a sci-fi movie. This thing's just, I didn't even know we had them out here. They're all over Michigan, shit. I mean, everywhere you had them. And so I'm sitting in there and we're eating lunch. It was Johnny and I and Trey. And they just start coming up out of the, I mean, it's crazy.
Spooky.
Never seen anything like it. You know, which would have been great if somebody was swimming there. There was like thousands of them just start coming up to the surface. And man, they were so distinctly brown and yellowy tan on the bottom. Like they all, I mean, you knew it was a chestnut instantly. And they're that long, right? And so that was the original Peanut Envy, that color combo. And so, any rate, you know, if they're not on that reactionary, then you got to think food because you only have two. You don't have the random, oh, I think, you know, it's just like they're either doing something or they're not. And so you switch. So I generally start, depending on sky color, I start for reactionary. Bright day, stuff like that. Dark day, low ceilings, raining, I go just the opposite. I start really dark. So generally black or olive, and or really dark brown sometimes. And because it's more food-based and it's slowed. And so now we're gone from, we've had one thing that's just a total waste of time. We wasted an hour and some great water, right? And we switch over and you say, okay, what can I do to change my luck? Well, make, just like with color, make big movements. Don't make a subtle movement. Don't go from chartreuse to white, you know, chartreuse and white. You haven't changed shit. So go big. And so we got in, had that canopy, kind of not cloudy, but shaded the water a little bit, put on the brown, and went completely slow motion jigging. I was doing a vertical jig off those, throwing it out, letting it come up and over, and just kind of lazy ass. You know, and if you're a rope puller, and this is what you do, it's really hard to pick your flies up, right? And so that's why I just encourage people, learn to, if you don't know, if you're going to do this, great, learn to jig your fly. Get your fly to do this, right? Just up and down. And so we went from reactionary speed, burning it, to a slower day, slower retrieve, and making the fly do this. I'm just swimming along. I got no problem with anybody. Don't eat me. First thing, just like that. Right? Good, woke your ass up. So, I mean, that's what it does. It's like, and so three fish, boom, 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 boom. But if you remember, then we changed flies. Because we knew they're on that. We went to olive, that's all we did, to see if, and bigger, and went back and blah, blah, blah. But your reactionary is usually speed and color, and your food is usually slower and duller. Yep. Right? Kind of like Johnny, slower and duller. And so
poor Johnny.
He'll be here next week to defend himself. He's such a little but anyway, so reactionary versus that. It's like anything else. It's a style.
Yeah.
If you fished any other style in the world, you would have multiple lures, right, that do multiple things. We have basically two ways we can fish our flies, either like this or there we go.
So I think you hit on something really important there. And it was kind of the takeaway I had is when you think fish are going to be on a reactive bite, mm-hmm. I'm generally fishing, and tell me if I'm wrong, I'm generally fishing larger and brighter profiles, oftentimes bigger heads. And that, you know, that's not necessarily a rule. Like I fish that slick willy when I'm looking for reactive bites a lot, right. And that's a skinny profile, but it's obnoxious, right? I'm thinking.
Lots of movement.
I'm thinking obnoxious.
Right.
Movement, get in there and for lack of a better term, like fuck with them, right? Mm-hmm. it's screwing up their day. And then when I think, food-based bite, I'm thinking smaller, more natural colors, darker, your browns, your tans, mm-hmm. your olives, your blacks. And then oftentimes, you know, I love that peanut envy. If you guys aren't fishing peanut envies, fish peanut envies. Matt and I used to joke, are we good at streamer fishing or do we just fish peanut envies?
All of you now.
Yeah, I mean, it's my number one fly. It's not even that close. So I draw those distinctions, and then I think that the other kind of light bulb moment I had, I remember at the time it was my biggest brown ever. It ate a black and purple mini.
16?
What's that? Yeah, 16. 16 and a quarter, Johnny. It ate a black and purple mini dungeon. It was 23 and a quarter, and it felt like that fish knew it was coming. It hit the water. And it was, you know, that fish came out of a foot and a half of water. It was kind of an undercut, not really. There's no room for that fish to be under there. It was on the bank. Mm-hmm. And my fly hit the water, and that fish hit it going forward. And I barely had a chance to move it, and all of a sudden I was fighting a fish. It's like I didn't know what happened. And that was kind of the moment where I was like, okay, that's a reactive bite. And I don't think the fly would have mattered there. Because I landed that fly right in front of that fish's face. I don't think it had time to care about color, care about anything. And I don't think that's true of all reactive bites. But that's when I switched to a bigger fly, a brighter profile.
Reactionary is reactionary. It means something triggered it. It doesn't necessarily have to be bright. So that's a start point.
Yeah. Well, and it's fun.
Yeah, it's fun, but we use plenty of black and olive and mm-hmm. natural dungeons, stuff like that are still reactionary bites if you're ripping them.
Right.
But you can take a lot of those and slow them down. And again, one fish doesn't crack a code, right?
Pattern. Yeah.
And so, and it may have just said, something's in my turf and it's dying. You know, everything that's in the water to a fish is food. They're afraid of nothing. I mean, I have shown the pictures of the snake eater many times. I do it in all my seminars. When the fish is hungry, or you know, they'll eat virtually anything. I've often referred to it like that movie Jaws, when they were cleaning it and they're pulling out tire, license plate, you know, cigarette, who knows, and all this shit comes out. A food bite, in particular, it needs continuity. It needs smooth. It needs much more dulled down. It's food, and their food is not generally bright and shiny, right? And so
there ain't no white sculpin in the river, 7 inches long.
Yeah, going,
not that I've seen,
swimming above their heads, because right. Sculpin are all, you know, rock dwellers, right? I want to see the day you see a sculpin up in the mid column. They don't really have the ability to do that. And so the difference is just simply you have to decide. I mean, you if you watch any kind of competitive anything, if you're a golfer, you don't walk up with a three all day, right? You walk up and you look at it and you go, you know, it's a sand wedge. It's a whatever. I don't know. I don't golf.
Driver always.
But yeah, it's a driver, whatever. And here it is. And so, but if you're an angler, if you're a bass angler, I mean, just watch one bass show and look at the guys, the good guys. They'll have 12 rods on the deck. They don't have the same freaking lure on them. They don't have the same type of line on them. They don't have, nothing is by chance. They don't just say, oh shit, I gotta have 10 rods on this deck so everybody think I look cool. Every single rod has a function. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's braid, maybe it's floral, maybe, you know, this one's a drop shot, maybe this one's a suspension bait. Who knows what it is? But you gotta keep moving, and you're getting paid to win, right? And you're only getting paid if you win. And so, you need to make those decisions. So with a fly angler, we tend to go out and just throw it and just pull and pull and pull. And then I hear it a lot, well, they weren't on, right? And that there's those days. It doesn't matter who it is. So I said, I don't know, whichever podcast we did a little while ago, where I said, it's just kind of an ego buster, but if you're having a great day, probably the whole freaking river's having a great day. It's really, really, really rare to have one person, like if 12 of our guides walk in at the same time, if it sucked for 11 of them, it only just barely didn't suck for the 12th, right? It's a day. Usually, I mean, there's a difference, obviously, but what you normally see on superstar guides who can crack a code is in that day where everybody else got skunked or got one or two fish, the superstar maybe got five or six, but didn't roll no 30. No 30, 40 fish day thing. None of that shit. It's all, but you're alone. You're not talking to your buddy upstream saying, are you killing him? Yeah, I got this. So you've got to go through this thing. And so for me, breakdown wise, bright days, bright flies, fast movement. Dark day, dark fly, slow movement. But that's just the starting
point.
It's
just a start.
And then you go crisscross. I mean, Johnny and I fished one day here in February. Probably the last day I fished with him. It was freezing. It got nice, but the water temperature, I will never remember. But we ask him, he remembers everything. I don't know how he does that. He remembers that day, what temperature that was, what the barometer was. He can tell you 10 years ago that shit. And it was a flat out, not going to be a fast day. And they ate the living shit. We were fishing golden, I think it was either the Pearl Necklace or the Golden Showers when they first came out. And they were absolutely, it's such a whippy, bright, flashy fly, whip tail on it. It was the original ones that were marabou tails. I think it was the Golden. And we just absolutely clobbered it. which on a day that shouldn't have, we should have just been out there bitching at each other because we're freezing.
Yeah.
Because dumbass doesn't get cold. That drives me crazy too. Man does not get cold. And so, anyway, they can break all the rules.
Yeah, they break rules, right? Yeah. But I think the golf analogy is great. You got to have different clubs in your bag. And we talked about this a little bit in our first podcast. Is your dog messing with you down there?
No, I'm trying to keep the thing. I'm trying to stop from fidgeting. And I got a one-wheel wagon here. So I put a little thing underneath it. So I quit making noise. So your sister quit bitching about my squeaking. You know.
Sorry, no, Riley. No. Thanks for listening. She doesn't fish at all, so I can tell she loves me.
She's just here for my charming personality.
Yeah, that's it.
10 times more charming than that pig on Green Acres.
So back to this golf analogy. The, you know, understanding reactive versus food bites allows you to do more in the water instead of just one thing. And to me, you know, throwing a giant white fly, trying to induce a reactive bite, it's almost like hitting driver. Right, you can hit it a long ways. It's super fun. It's the big stick.
Mm-hmm.
The food bite is technical. It's almost like hitting an 8-iron from 50 yards. It's a bump and run, right? It's not sexy, but it's important to have that tool in your bag, that club in your bag, so that when they're not eating the reactive bite, if you're spraying your driver in the woods, you better have another option.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a big light bulb for me, was kind of understanding.
And I think that's the most important thing to breaking the hunt portion of it from the hope. When you have that second technique and you understand, to understand the vertical jig or a dying drift, whatever, again, back to practicing so you know what your fly is doing. If you get that, that is the difference between fishing okay and Johnny. You know, when you go with Johnny, he does not allow you to sit idly and hope that fish. He's doing something, and sometimes people think, like we're changing really fast, like you're hoping one works. Well, you are hoping one works, but you're doing something different.
You're going by a system.
You're going as a system, and you're going to go fast, 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 slow, slow, dark fly, dark fly. You're going to have some way that tells you, I'm in control of my own destiny. I'm going to at least have a play in it. I'm going to say, well, if it's going to suck all day, at least at the end of the day, I'm going to have a gut pile of flies that big, and I'm going to have a really sore arm.
I can't say I didn't do my part.
Exactly. Right? You've done everything humanly possible. You've went through every data point you've stored in the last, you know, for you fishing the last 6 weeks or whatever, for, you know, 40 years of data points. And you are just going all out to attempt to do something different. You know, if you're a dry fly cat, you can go out and you know the bugs and you can't crack the code. There's only so many things you can put on there if you're going to stay dry.
Yep.
You know you got a caddis, they're eating caddis like hell, and you've got X amount of variables. Well, we don't have that when we're streamer fishing. We can do everything. In particular, the one thing I would say about that, the one code cracker for me that is almost always when it saved my ass is jigging a crayfish. And a slow jig, people want to jig their flies like this. You can't, first of all. Well, you can on a floater, but virtually impossible unless you were sitting like this right down there. But the ability to move a fly with a soft cadence that just kind of emulates, you know, crayfish are pretty fast movers when they actually do swim, and they don't go up and down very high. Like about 10, 11 inches would be a lot of movement from the bottom up. They don't want to be up in the water column. They know their food. But the difference between a slow day, this fish, this is the original, that is the original, where is that thing? I thought I had another one up there. This is kind of the color it ended up. This is the original. It's kind of faded. This is the dumbest. That is the OG.
Anglerfish.
Right? It's actually not the OG. It's the second one. But this fly is so, this particular one you'd see on if you're buying them. This thing just, it's my fly that when it's just everything sucking for me and I put this on and I catch a fish, always is my savior.
I mean, I've seen it 3 or 4 times now.
It's ridiculous, yeah. Right? Why don't you start with the thing? Well, I just don't, right? And it's. I had one guy write in when we were doing the video on it, and he goes, "Is that your joke on the fly fishing community?" Johnny's my joke on the fly fishing community. Are you shitting me?
Poor guy.
No. It's just such a... But anyway, I think the difference between being really good at it and stopping is just breaking your cycle quicker. Yep. When you break... I mean, I fish with so many people that fish essentially 3 flies, right? And some days they catch fish, you know, and they just crush it. And then some days they just don't. And so I... Personally, if I had to have 3 fly, I don't think I would do it. I would just, there wouldn't be any code cracking on that.
Well, I think, so like you said, when the fish are on, they're on.
Mm-hmm.
And probably everyone's having a great day. I think that these tactics and the, you know, having different speeds, having different flies, having different colors, profiles, all that.
Fly lines.
I think that all this really helps on the mediocre days where maybe it's not going crazy. This might help you get into a few fish that the guy who's just fishing black woolly buggers isn't going to get.
Absolutely, you nailed it. Absolutely correct. The super days, I was just talking to Jack Dennis, messaged Jack, and we were talking about 9/11 when Randall Kaufman and McCullough and Jack and I were on the... We're over on the Wind, and we had. There's 2 boats, and Darren Calhoun owns the fishing rights over there, and it's on the Indian Reservation, and he took us up to the Upper Crowheart, and we had a day that was pretty ridiculous, and it was right. This was right in the infancy of the TNA bunker, and I had done one in kind of a grayish color. And we're stopped eating lunch. We're just sitting there munching. And I'm, as usual, take a bite of the sandwich, whatever, and futzing with my flies and seeing if they're organized right. And what have I missed? What have I done? Go to my drying box. I'm looking at shit, right?
This is OCD, by the way.
Yeah, just a little. I'm like, oh, and I'm like, wow. At least that day, it was kind of glaciated, the water was. And I particularly like to match my watercolors. If I got tannic water, I'm going with Bob's Butt Monk. Bob's original butt monkey, butt monkey is not my fly. I get credit for it. Bob's the one that tied it. I did the articulated version, but it's still Bob's fly. And his original brown and tan was designed, I believe, for coaster brook trout on the Nipigon, which is always tannicky, right? And so I like to match my watercolors to my fly colors to start, or some in the beginning in particular. And that day it was kind of glaciated green and grayish looking. And I had a gray TNA bunker. And I didn't know, you know, they're not fishing that kind of shit over there yet. They're just still on the maybe on the bugger thing. And I take the fly and I show it to Randall. And he'd never seen anything like it. And he goes, I said, I don't know if they're going to eat it or not. And I'm eating lunch and I throw it out the side of the boat. It's damp because I showed it to him dry and then I got it wet and showed him how the profile didn't change. Threw it out the side of the boat. Turn around and I'm talking to Ralston. My rod starts going down. And I thought it got hung up on something. And I got my biggest cutty of the day. Like a 5-pound cutty. Ate the son of a bitch. Must have been parked underneath our boat. Because literally the fly is hanging from here to the... It's just maybe the rod's sideways and it's in a... I had it kind of wedged here, and it caught the stanchion on that. We're in rafts, and it's just like, whoa, 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 like this, and it's just crashing. It's my biggest cutty I got over there. So there's a day where everything's going to go right, right? So if it wasn't that day, though, that wouldn't have happened. Now, they're eating everything. They're on a suicide bite. Yeah. If it was a slow day, you'd go through that and hope that it didn't. I'm not sure that's where we were going with that. I just remembered it. I saw Randall's name and I went, oh yeah, I remember that day. Free radical.
Anyway, she goes. Sometimes she goes, sometimes she doesn't.
Yeah.
Okay, so kind of teeing off on that, and going back to the crayfish thing, I want to talk about a line that you had that just had me absolutely dying, and I missed it while we were filming. When I was editing, I was just cracking up at the table. You're talking about the importance of having two retrieves and jigging, and we're up between the lakes, and you put on a Nancy B. And you say, to my knowledge, there are no crayfish in the system. But the fish doesn't know that.
Yeah.
Maybe he thinks it's the first one ever.
Maybe.
I cracked up at that image. But I think that the question out of that is, how important is it to know the forage in your river? And kind of, I think I know what you're going to say, and therefore...
I never do.
Therefore, how do we... What is the common angler, what's the mistake they make when they think about a fish in their intelligence?
I don't think they have intelligence, personally. I've said that many, many times, that I don't think they have, I don't think they really have memory so much as far as like, oh, that fly. I mean, I think they have memory of you're walking, that means I should move out. But I don't think they have any cognizant reasoning. I don't think they, if they could put things together, we'd never catch them, I don't think. But as far as food forage bases, I think it's really important. And I think it's one of the reasons that like a woolly bugger or really basic woolly sculpins and things like that are so effective, because they cover a broad spectrum of things, right? And so, but knowing your food, your forage base, I think is really critical, because if you say you've got a red-sided shiner and it's July and they're spawning, well, red-sided shiner looks like every other shiner until it's time to spawn, and now it's got this giant yellow. We got to find a picture of that and show it, because it's got a, you know, super red belly and giant yellow stripe and black back and bright tail, and if they're feeding on those, it behooves you to understand that you're probably going to have a great day on those. But if all you have is a, you know, whatever, black woolly bugger, it's pretty generic, but it's not covering that. So, and that's, again, knowing your food sources. Crayfish and stuff like that, there's also this just pure curiosity for a trout. And there's this thing that, and we just kind of think it looks like a crayfish, right? Maybe it looks like something else, I don't know. But they'll eat a lot of stuff. I mean, like I said in one of the videos, that big brown that I found that had the red-winged blackbird wing in it. And what the hell did that look like?
How?
Yeah, and he ate it, right? It was a big, it was a she, actually. She ate that big female. But at any rate, they, knowing the forage base is critical to me. One, I'm a student of observation, and I want to know everything about that river, right? I want to know, I don't give a shit what river it is on the planet, what creek. I want to have an idea. Like the idea that I didn't know there was chestnut lampreys in that lower Henry's Fork. Mm-hmm. And so that gives me something that you didn't have, right? You don't have that when you're out there throwing just a reactionary fly or whatever it is, just because it fished good on the Madison or on the, you know, fished great back in the Delaware or wherever you're fishing. And you get here and, for example, the shad on the white, right? I was always under the impression those the kills when I first heard about it before I'd fished them was, you know, a shad, like I'm thinking like an alewife, something pretty big, like a gizzard shad or something like that. And here comes these thousands of these things, right? And everybody said, well, just fish a woolly bugger, a white woolly bugger. I'm thinking, it doesn't look anything. Well, then I find out that the shad are that big, and that can be bigger too. But I mean, that's, it was just like, I wanted to know everything about that forage base. And so, and then that's what, you know, people ask me about designing flies. What triggers me, like two of these, a couple of one of guys talked about Bob dropping that fish and that rainbow pops out, out comes the TNA bunker. The original TNA was not for that. It was for bunker, it was for an alewife pattern. in the Great Lakes, and I think it was Russ that was going to troll it. And then I put the rainbow one together, and we saw that. But what triggers me is, like, I forget where I was going to go. I don't recall, but it was some ditch. The first thing I did was I got online, and I looked up at the Department of Natural Resources for that area and said, you know, forage base. And here's all the, you know, they showed me every possible thing that was in it. Well, really wasn't any different than here. So I'm fine. I'm all good. But then the crayfish thing, that the crayfish, like up there, if there are any, now there are in Hebgen Lake. You know, I know there's thousands of them up there. I mean, and I assume that there's some. I just never personally seen one.
I've never seen one either.
And I've never, ever seen even a carpus. Nothing down here in my life. They eat the living crap out of them here, right? They just, but I think a lot of that is that just natural food, that wavy, here it is, and what else? And like I said, everything that swims, if you think of a shark, there's nothing it won't eat, right? It'll eat anything. Well, so will a trout. A brown trout will do the same. Imagine if a brown trout got to be 150 pounds. We'd all be dead. So it should eat every one of us, right? And so...
mean bastards.
Oh, my God. It would make a shark look like a freaking guppy. You'd be so... Nobody would ever get close to the water. And so here's this thing that... So I think it's important, and I was trying to hit on the point that for me, it's important to know that I've done my, and that's all Dave Ellis. That's all that Dave, I keep talking about this guy. He'd find out everything about the drainage we were going to. If we're going to fish this, he'd know everything. He'd call people. Mm-hmm. He'd ask people if they know anybody that knows anybody, and he'd call that guy, right? He just really went full on. And so I started doing it, obviously, because of him. And then I just found it way more interesting than to get there. It's kind of like when we got down to Chile I said, let me guess, and I opened his fly box, and it was like three colors of woolly buggers in two sizes. That doesn't stimulate my brain to go fish anymore. I mean, I get it that we're here to catch fish, but I want to know what's in the Foodle Flu. What is in this thing? Yeah. Just for no other reason than it, when they're not eating the damn woolly bugger, maybe you got something else they'll eat, you know?
Well, and if they're not on a super reactive bite, then maybe you need to imitate a food source.
Right. I mean, that's the difference between reactionary and food,
yeah.
Is that one's slower. And there's something else to that. Slower means more inspection time. So you take a fathead kitty or bangtail, and you fish it super slow, lots of inspection time.
Yeah, they can come up and just
you can look at it from 3 feet going.
Oh, there aren't white sculpin in this
river. Yeah, but when it's hauling ass, triggers, reaction. And so when it gets time for food stuff, say there are leeches going through the water like this. See, maybe there are leeches there. Maybe they're swimming. And they don't. If you've ever watched a chestnut or any of those leeches swim, they're not... You know, they're just wormy. They're just little snakes, right? And so if they're on food and you just have fast, you're screwed. It's not likely you're going to get fish.
I think one of the most powerful analogies in my mind that, you know, I used to tell people in the shop, and I can't remember if it's yours or someone else's, but throw a mouse fly in front of a cat. Is that yours?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you set it there, the cat doesn't give a shit.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you rip it away, it's instinctual, right? Yeah. So that's kind of that reactive.
I use that in my seminars where I tell people to take a 7-weight with the neighbor's cat and a big mouse pattern and slap it beside that thing.
Cut the hook off.
Whatever. Depends if you like the cat. And so down goes the fly, and the cat will do this. The cat will do what every predator... It's what you should do too. Something scares you in the street, don't run. You got canines for a reason. Face it.
Look at it.
See what's worse, getting killed by a bear this way or running from it. Face it. You know, at least got a shot, right? So here's your deal. The fly hits. Cat's over here. He goes like that, and he's on it. He will lock on that thing so tight. Same thing with the trout, except the trout's faster. So the fly hits, and again, fly hits, it's a reactionary thing. The fish already knows. It knows the second that fly hits the water, it's already locked like the cat on that mouse pattern. The mouse sits there and doesn't do anything. Cat's going to figure out it's a bunch of fur and shit, right?
Yeah.
And then you, so if it hits, he looks at it and it tries to run away, boom, you got it. That's reactionary. But if you're trying to do, you know, you want it to come, they're not on that thing. They're on wounded frog or whatever, something. There's right. something that they get the time to walk up and look at it. So something's ripping ass through there and they have to do that reaction. If they're on that, that's great. But if they're used to watching things, you know, really slow, maybe baby gophers or whatever the hell this cat's eating, right? They're not running away from them, but they're kind of locked on those. You better have a fly, because when that fly slows down, hits the water, and reactionary bites are usually within the first 2 or 3 seconds, right? Food-based bites are almost always a third of the way back.
Yeah.
They follow that thing. They're like this. It's seldom. If you get one, it's in the beginning, it's on the drop. It's just, it's going like this, and that's usually right about there, right? But usually they track it a while. And that's the real difference, is a food bite's a track thing, and a reactionary bite's like, holy shit, I didn't even get to move it, right? So you got to have, and obviously the flies have to duplicate your action.
Right. So I think going back to the forage thing, two tips for anglers that, you know, are trying to improve, trying to understand this whole forage thing. One, like you said, DNR, FWP, whatever your local or state authority is, oftentimes does research and surveys on the waterways.
I don't know one that doesn't.
I think they all do. Yeah, all that information do. Is public. So go online, find those. Any waterway you're going to fish, many of them have survey data on them. You can go find that.
For that matter, and the lake people probably know this already, but they have the same thing on your lakes.
Yeah, same thing on lakes, everything. So that's a good way to figure out what the forage might be. The other way is power of observation. I mean, just yesterday, I'm not good at looking down. I get to a river and I'm so intent on fishing and blah, blah, blah. I don't take enough time. I know that about myself. And yesterday I was fishing with Lucas. We're walking back up. We've been in the river. We're on the Mo around Craig. It's a secret. Don't go there.
Yeah, nobody's been there.
Nobody's been there before. And, you know, we're walking back up at the end of the day. It's 4:30. That sun's going down. And he goes, man, do you see all those crayfish? I don't think I looked down a single time. I mean, we're swinging flies. But, maybe I should have put one of those on. And we're walking back up the bank, and there's dozens of them, right?
Well, one thing about you're walking up the bank, and you guys are swinging, right? I'm going to digress here. The good news is, so tons of crayfish. I did, with the help of Jerry and Jerry, 7 hours of observation of crayfish. I usually end that with, I swear to God, I had a date once. Nothing is more boring on the planet. And I didn't do it all as one set, right?
Yeah.
And I did, and I don't even count the dozens and dozens, you know, hundreds maybe of hours I spent in the Great Lakes snorkeling around looking at crayfish. But in the river, I have never seen a crayfish swim. I've sat and just watched right next to this big weed bed, particularly nice day. Jerry Dennis, I think, was rowing me, it was him and I that day. And this particular day, and I sat there for quite a while watching these things while he fished. And then I had them, later I had them throw flies at me. And so, but what I would do is I would sit and watch them when I was there, and I would mess them. I kept a stick with me and I would poke at them and stuff to see what they would do. And bring something at them quick to see if they'd run, hide somewhere, trying to figure out something to do with crayfish behavior. And geez, just so boring, because they don't do shit. They don't do anything. They don't swim around. They crawl everywhere.
They don't want to leave rocks, yeah, right?
It was sandy and there were some rocks and stuff. Yeah, but anything that they can underneath, right? And when you did, occasionally one would just kind of like from here to there. I mean, just instead of crawling, you'd like, zoom a little bit over to this side. Usually get undercover. And when I'd put stuff over their heads, you know, they'd kind of backwards a little bit. Usually they'd run. And so then I would poke them, right, and make them go. And one thing I saw, as I said earlier, I never saw one go much more than 10, 11 inches up, and then they go down. And rough guessing, the most I ever saw one move, well, I saw one in the Great Lakes once go from rock pile to rock pile, which is about 6 feet away, and just to get right down. I kind of got him out in the open. I started poking him, and he just took off. Mm-hmm. And maybe like a fish would do. He took off to get underneath. It's the only thing that could get the next piece of rock, right? That was giant boulders. And so, but on the river things, they generally, they all of them went downstream that I can recall, and I'd poke them, and they so they didn't go up very high. They tried to stay really close, but they pull with their ass, right? They've got their carapace up their shell, and then they got their tail, and they pull like this, and they just, and they can go pretty quick. And, but when I would watch them, they didn't look like much. They didn't go up very high. And what I would see is their pinchers were always behind them, you know? And so they almost always were crossed. And when they would scoop with their ass, they'd turn sideways. And they'd turn sideways. It was like they didn't, and they scoop. Their hind ends are really pulling like this. And all you see is this gap between their pinchers. And you see is light, dark, light, dark, light, dark, light, dark, light, dark. It's not, you don't see the shape of the crayfish. You don't see much of anything except this tone changing because their bellies are lighter because it's going to be the color of the bottom usually. And their carapaces are a little darker on the top depending on the time of year. They molt a lot. They do 13 times a year. Generally, they do their spawning at about 65 degrees. Almost all crayfish do. And then they can molt a lot, and so they'll be vulnerable at different times of soft shell, especially right previous to spawn, which they get, that's a whole nother time frame, but it's usually water temperature. It's really, and I'm pretty certain it's all crayfish do this, it's usually 65 to 68 degrees when they spawn, so it hits that. It's when they do that big soft shelling, which is just mayhem for the trout. They love that thing, but they don't have any problem eating them with the hard shells. They don't give a shit. And that's the most common thing I found in having taxidermied for 30 some years, and there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of trout. The most common thing is a crawfish part. It's usually a claw of some sort. But anyway, here comes you and you're coming down and you haven't paid attention to your river and you're swinging, which is a very passive thing. Okay. Now, I told you in this diving thing, then afterwards, because this is one of the times when crayfish are just starting, you're just starting to see people. Dave Whitlock had one kind of fixed clawed thing, and then other guys started doing some and here and there. And so I had all of them with me, and they would, Jerry Dennis, I believe it was swinging these at me, right, so I can see them. Mm-hmm. Absolutely looked like shit. Almost every fly that was out there at that point, especially if they had any sort of fixed claw, like glued like this,
yeah,
totally dog shit. They would spin in a circle. They'd be all right, just dead drifting, and then, but they look like nothing, because you need to, no matter how good you think they look to your eye, they don't look like that floating in the river. They just look like a gob of shit. And so all these flies, they're either spinning or they're tipped upside down. Once they'd initiate the swing, you'd see them coming like this, and they'd get down, and it's not fast water either. This is slow water. And they'd come down, but they're just not looking like shit. So now I had him throw a woolly bugger. I personally think a woolly bugger is a crayfish pattern. It is the most accurate looking. And then we had a JJ. There was a brown on yellow tail. Now, all of a sudden, here comes this JJ with its rubber legs and yellow. And here it comes. And all of a sudden, I see light, dark, light, dark, light, dark, light, dark, light, dark. So it is my assumption that the woolly bugger is, if you two-tone its tail, which you'll see in my fly box, I have a lot of light-colored tan tails and a dark top tail. And a lot of the flies do that. And so this fly comes down, and so you're out swinging this run. Doesn't matter that you don't know shit about your environment, and you probably get eaten by a bear, and the fact that you were looking for Sacagawea's footprint, and you thought you were the only person that was there before you.
I was.
And so, you know, it'd be a cool little print. But the swing, you take the intruders, I think they're pure. I think the entire Mont, which you guys, one of your favorite flies in the world, right?
Yeah. That's Montana Intruder, slidein.com. Don't buy it. It works really good.
Yeah, don't buy that. It's the only thing you guys fish anymore. And there's just a peanut envy.
I ordered 24 this year.
I think it's a crayfish pattern. If you look at a crayfish that's actually swimming and you find, you know, take the time to actually do something and you'll go down, you'll see that. And when you see the tail of the intruder with its bulky little head, well, I guess it could be a minnow. It's also a great crayfish. Woolly bugger, absolutely for sure, is a 10 times better as a, people say it's a great leech. I don't think it's that great a leech. If you took the hackle off, it'd be pretty good, I suppose. But
and did half as much marabou in the tail.
Yeah.
I mean, you can see it in the water. The taper's there for crayfish.
Two-tone, that tail. And I'm telling you, that to me, I think that's why the intruder, I think they're a better crayfish. And who cares if I'm dead wrong? It's a great crayfish, and it's a great bait fish.
Yeah.
Who
yeah.
gives a shit? Well, I don't even know who tied
that. I would
argue
that the Montana intruder is nothing. I mean, I'm swinging it in the top Maybe. Of the column. It's just flashy. I think it's like a spinner, mm-hmm. essentially. It's just
yeah,
nothing. I mean, I who knows what they're thinking it is. All I know is that
I just told you. You don't have to wonder anymore.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Okay, thank you. Yeah. No, I mean, who cares what they think it is? They eat it. But it's good to have reasons for why we do things.
I don't know on the colors. But, you know, when a crayfish goes through that molting process, when you find them soft shell, and they can be, I mean, like shrimp orange.
Yeah.
You can find them in every color phase. Hell, there's albino. There's all kinds of them. And they're all over. But the commonality is that they do not free swim anywhere I've ever seen. And they don't. And it's real easy not to see them. Kind of like a sculpin.
Right.
Last time you saw a freaking sculpin. Yeah. Remember when that river shut off and we were out there and all we're trying to save all those fish
Before
and whatever?
I was here.
Oh, is that before you were here?
Yeah. I showed up that spring.
You're like a wart. It seems like you've been around forever. But anyway, there was so... The two things on this river that I think are a mystery, Johnny didn't really buy into it until then either, I don't think. The number of shrimp that are in this river and bajillion, nobody can't convince people to tie one on. And the number of sculpin this big under a rock this size, you tip a rock up like that because the water's drying out and they're just kind of staying in that moisture. Mm-hmm. And underneath here, and a rock that size might have 35, 40 juvenile sculpin. They're this big, right? This big.
Tiny.
Tiny little things. And then you got the adults that are locked in and, you know, for the most part, slimy or mottled up here. You know, a big one's going to be, you know, a giant one might be that big. 3.5 to 4 would be a giant one.
Huge, yeah.
When's the last time you ever saw one? You don't see them free swimming. No swim bladder.
No.
Well, we have a swim bladder.
When I notice them is when I'm romping down the bank.
Yeah.
And they're so goddamn fast.
Yeah.
They fly. I mean, you step and...
Right on the bottom.
It's not like I see them. I see kind of where they were.
Yeah.
You know, you see a tiny shape go and then a little puff of dust.
And they're right here on the bottom.
Yeah. No, they don't
get up. Because they can't do this.
No.
They don't have that ability. When they get up here, they're screwed.
Right.
And they're meat. And if you think about how many are here and how little that they have and how often... Man, I wish Johnny was here. As much shit as I give Johnny, he forgets nothing, and he databases, and like he could tell us how many fish were caught last year that people had for everybody that had a sculpin hanging out their mouth, mm-hmm. right? And be like, oh yeah, we had 31 of them last year. Okay, and he's right. And there's a tail sticking out. That fish had to actively find that. They aren't up there swimming around. They have to see him like trying to go from this rock under to this rock.
Sculpin swim into his mouth.
No, they have to go look for those things. Same with the crayfish. They have to look for them. And just a real sidebar, just in case you ever fish for bull trout by accident, places you can fish them, jig a Nancy. I mean, and they will not come and charge it very often. They'll come over, jig it really slow, let it touch bottom if you can. Just kind of go like this, go like this, go like this. And they'll come over and they'll grab that thing and they'll shake the shit out of it. They'll just shake it and they'll hold it and they'll turn around and swim. But they don't rip over like they do you'll see it. You'll see them just coming. They're just like, they see it, and they just swim over, and they just bite it, and then shake their head trying to get, imagine trying to kill it. It's really cool.
I really enjoy, not sure enjoy is the right word. I like thinking of fish like sharks. I don't have a ton of experience around sharks, but the experience I do is like, you know, my dad needed to piss off the flats boat, and he was hot, so he decided to jump in. Well, immediately you see a dark shape 200 yards off move.
Coming to see you.
It's like you were talking about with the cat, right? You land that fly, they're going to turn and look. They know it's there.
Yeah.
And I think it's similar to bull trout with a food-based bite, kind of like a Nancy. If that thing hits the water, if it's not moving fast, they're not going to come, you know, bum rush it super fast to eat it.
Right.
They're going to make their way over and eat it. Kind of like a shark would, right?
They know.
If there's a big dead whale, the shark isn't racing. They're going to swim over there, take a bite, and tear it off.
They don't have to.
Yeah. I mean, fish are fish.
Exactly.
All right.
People are people.
People are people. And assholes have been around forever.
At least since the 16th century.
At least since the 16th century. A random question before we end. How many people in kind of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem do you think have been killed by the person, the killer, trying to protect a fishing spot?
That's pretty random.
I was thinking about this yesterday. It's got to have happened at least once.
I have no idea.
It must have happened.
There had to be a woman involved.
Yeah, probably.
That was probably... I don't know anything about the...
How many people have you killed protecting fishing spots?
Not many until I got my backhoe.
Oh, right.
That made it a lot easier. Digging holes out here is really a pain in the ass.
Yeah, a lot of rocks.
I don't have a spot. I never did have... I used to get really pissed at that. And I would... It was the betrayal of my friendship which pissed me off when I would tell you this is the spot. I take you to a spot, but you can't come back without me. That's sacred ground stuff. You don't ever, ever betray that friendship. And when you do that, it happened to Jerry Wilson, which to a guy, and it's 25 years ago and he's still... It scares me when he sees them. So it's just something that, it's not necessarily the fishing spot. It's the fact that I told you, and it was so that just you and I, and not you and your buddy and somebody else's buddy. I think we talked about that in the last podcast.
I think we did.
It's about, you just don't betray that. If somebody... It's just a total disrespect. It's you're lying. You are a false prophet. You lied and you said you wouldn't and you did, and then out comes the shovel and away you go.
Now we know what you're made of.
Like Danny across the street sign says, "I have guns and a backhoe," and he means it.
Don't mess with him. He means it. All right, well, I think that's a great place to wrap up episode 5. Like I said, next week we're going to sit down with Johnny, so it'll be a great, I don't know, Battle of the Titans, something like that.
Titan.
Yeah, I don't know. Johnny
Tiny
Titan.
Tim.
Yeah. come back next week.
We're going to have different sized chairs.
Yeah, we'll boost yours up a little.
Yeah, I'll have to be like this.
we'll try to make sure you guys are at the same level. But
maybe I'll have a new chair. I'll put Johnny in this one, so he's the one doing this constantly.
Oh, he's gonna hate it.
He'll get all weird and have to walk out. I gotta get a different chair.
Oh, I gotta get a
chair. Sit on that thing you're sitting on.
All right. Well, thanks for watching, everyone. And
appreciate
come back
it.
Next week. I hope you enjoyed it, and we will see you soon.
Hope it helps you out.
Oh, like and subscribe.
I
don't. I always try to make Kelly say that, and I can't.
I'm really 5 times in history, or maybe more. Yeah.
Like, subscribe.
Like and subscribe. Follow. And again, hope you like it. Hope it helps you out.